Hi, welcome to another installment of For the Medical Record. I am Antoine Johnson.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And we are your esteemed hosts, postdoctoral fellows at the Johns Hopkins University in the Department of History and Medicine and the Center for the Medical Humanities and Social Medicine.
Which sponsors this podcast.
Yes, yes, yes. Today, oh, we got a good one for y'all. We are joined by Walker McGrath, who is a medical student here at Johns Hopkins. Walker's research interests include LGBTQ plus health equity, medical technology, and psychiatry. We also discussed a paper, Christy.
Yes. So the main topic of today's interview was Walker's paper, which was published in October of 2022, so just a couple months ago, called The Fall of the Nation's First Gender-Affirming Surgery Clinic, which was here at Hopkins. So we discuss with Walker the archival research that he did, the importance and the process of doing history as a medical student and doing the medical humanities and social medicine as a medical student, which of course is really interesting to us on this podcast and as two people who teach medical students and practicing physicians. So it's just a wonderful conversation. And we're really excited to bring it out to you guys.
Yes, yes, definitely. And I look forward to assigning this episode in my future classes.
Oh, for sure. Enjoy and let us know what you think.
Peace.
Okay, let's get started. Thank you so much for joining us. We're so excited to talk to you about your article. We're excited to finally have you on the podcast to chat it through. And yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, 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 definitely. Walker, to get us started, you know, you are a scholarly concentrator. Do you mind telling us what that means and how it fits into your medical school journey? More so, like, why do you think this is a valuable route for medical students? And just to add a tiny addition to this question, I'm curious about when you felt medicine was your calling.
Yeah, sure. That's a pretty big question, but I'll try to do my best answering it. I first decided I wanted to go to medical school when I was living in New York. I was doing some HIV and STI counseling at Gay Men's Health Crisis. And I really fell in love with the patient population I was working with. Beforehand, I was thinking maybe I would want to go into engineering because that's what I was studying. But I really decided that medicine was it for me through this experience in New York. And I decided to apply to medical school. And yeah, so basically coming back to your question about the scholarly concentration is something that we all have to do at Johns Hopkins between our first and second year of medical school. There, I think, are either four or five different concentrations you can do, one of which is the history of medicine. Not a lot of people pick it. There are only like four or five students that do it each year. Most people do clinical medicine or public health or like basic science research. And so it's basically just a dedicated period of time that we all have to basically do primary research of our own interests. And so I had never done history work before. I kind of was realizing that I was really interested in LGBTQ health, and I was really interested in just like exploring my various medical interests that I had never really explored before medical school. And I was talking to a bunch of people, and one person I reached out to was the current chair of the history of medicine at Hopkins, Jeremy Green. And we started talking, and I kind of decided that this would be a good idea to explore the history of medicine as my scholarly concentration. I also realized that at that time I was interested in plastic surgery, and I was interested in the history of gender surgery at our institution. And so all of these sorts of ideas were like swirling around in my head, and Jeremy Green helped me unpack it for a little bit. And so that's kind of how I got on to this project.
Thank you for that. And I just want to say this article shows that you know what you're doing. And I hope that you do more work in the history of medicine because this work is critical and needed in our subfield. So please keep it up.
Definitely.
But you did mention, we both are curious, you know, as a new person venturing into the field of history, what sort of methods did you find most difficult or problematic? Like, what did you struggle with? What was the biggest hurdles?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Something that really intimidated me about history before was just like the overabundance of resources and, you know, how many, you know, books and articles there are to sift through. And, you know, thankfully here at Johns Hopkins, we have really great resources in the history of medicine department. We have secondary literature specialists and people who can like really like unpack the library for you and say, this is where you need to find this information, this is where you can find the other information. So it made it a little more bearable for me. But yeah, I found kind of like sifting through that information to be difficult. I was, believe it or not, I'm not somebody who like loves to read like large volumes of text. And so I kind of was like learning throughout this concentration, like how to kind of deconstruct a big book and like kind of start from the back and like kind of look through the index and find, you know, important information and kind of go to the book through there. And so a lot of the stuff I learned through actually the didactics portion of the history of medicine scholarly concentration here. But yeah, anyways, I think another component of history research that is what I found to be the most compelling part of it is the archival work. And I really fell in love with working at the archives here at Johns Hopkins. And that's a whole different can of worms too, but that wasn't something that I necessarily was intimidated by. I think that was like the most exciting part of the research, but the thing that I was most intimidated by was definitely the sifting through the secondary literature.
Before passing it to Christy, and I'm sorry to hog, but I'm just really enjoying this conversation. You know, my work is on HIV and AIDS. So when you mentioned working with GMHC, you know, it just immediately grabbed my attention. But I'm curious if they've read this article, have you circulated this with the people who you worked with? Because I feel like they would love this and it'll be something that they'll, you know, share widely, probably have printed copies available for people walk in. Because like the people who I work with, like I try to make sure that whatever I produce, I share it with them. And I think GMHC would, I just assume that they will really appreciate your work.
Well, thank you for saying that. That really means a lot to me because GMHC is, you know, really like such an amazing organization that I, you know, really loved working with. And a lot of the people that I worked with there were, you know, some of the people that I probably learned the most in my medical training before I even came to Hopkins, how I learned to have non-judgmental, non-stigmatizing conversations with people. And GMHC is really the source of that. And so, yeah, I think that would be a great idea. I don't think any of the people there know that I wrote this or anything like that. But I think a lot of the ideas and like the sort of ideology that underpins this work is definitely related to the mission of GMHC and LGBTQ health equity.
Could you just say again what GMHC is, what it stands for?
Yeah, GMHC stands for Gay Men's Health Crisis. It was one of the first, I think might have been the first HIV clinic in the 1980s, whenever HIV and AIDS was, you know, first becoming a huge problem. It was kind of this like major organization for sort of destigmatizing sexual health care during a time whenever sex was very much stigmatized. And it was an activism organization as well. They worked a lot like lobbying different healthcare officials and trying to get certain policies passed and stuff like that. So they did a lot of work like that.
We'll be able to link GMHC as well in the show notes and everything so that they can get some foot traffic. Try to make sure that people can, you know, do their own research into the groups and the fields that we're talking about. We've hyped up your article and I said the title once, but I'm hoping that you can now just tell us, basically summarize the article. Can you tell us about the first gender affirming clinic and basically take us through your argument and what you found in the archives?
Absolutely. And I'll preface this with saying it's hard for me to give a very concise explanation of what the gender identity clinic was, but I can try my best to really summarize this article as best as I can. So as we were discussing, it was kind of born out of this like scholarly concentration work. But so the article is basically about how the first gender affirming surgery clinic in the United States existed at Johns Hopkins. It opened in 1966. It was groundbreaking for the time. It resulted in a lot of other gender clinics opening across the country. And for a moment there, at least for a decade or two, there was sort of a swelling of academic interest in gender-affirming surgery across the United States and internationally. And Johns Hopkins had a lot to do with that. And so the clinic operated for around 13 years or so. And then in 1979, it abruptly closed. And the gender identity clinic still like operated, you know, after that a little bit. It referred patients to surgery at other institutions. But in 1979, that was the hard line for Johns Hopkins and ending gender surgery specifically at Johns Hopkins Hospital. And so in my background research on the subject, I'd never found a really good explanation for why the gender clinic closed. There were a lot of sorts of ideas out there, probably the leading idea, and this is based off of like his own writing, but also other people's writings, that the former chief of psychiatry, Dr. Paul McHugh, came to Hopkins and decided that gender surgery no longer should be performed at Hopkins, and he shut down the clinic, you know, and that was like kind of a leading sort of hypothesis for what had happened. But to me, that sounded way too simple and it didn't quite make sense. And I thought there was more information involved. You know, another leading hypothesis was kind of just like, and this was a 2018 article written by clinicians at the Center for Trans Health. So this is like more of a modern historical article. And this article basically argued that like a financial limitations and a lack of personnel basically led to the clinic closing. And so, as you can imagine, these sorts of explanations didn't sound very, I don't know, they're just not very satisfying explanations. And quite honestly, I didn't think that they brought a lot of, you know, evidence that we have available to sort of answer this question of why the clinic closed. They kind of seemed like half-baked sorts of answers. And so I really hoped to kind of do a deep dive into the final days of the clinic. Honestly, the 13 years of its existence, but especially focusing on the last 10 years and the last 5 years, and try to figure out kind of all the different factors that were involved in the closure of the clinic. And so I kind of like outlined the article into like three different sorts of arguments that I have as supporting the closure of the clinic, the first of which being I titled personal bias and institutional interest. This was about the field of plastic surgery. And so I'm sure we'll get into this a little later on, but the chief of plastic surgery at the time, Dr. John Hoops, he was intimately involved with the clinic's founding in 1966. He left Hopkins for a period of time and he came back as chief of plastic surgery. And then during this period of time, this kind of between 1974 and 1979, he was very public about his opposition to gender surgery at Hopkins. So I found this to be kind of one of the initial supporting factors for the closure of the clinic that not many people have talked about previously. The second factor that I explored was this period of time between 1974 and 1978, where there really weren't any gender identity clinic archival primary sources available. And I found this very puzzling. There are gender identity clinic meeting minutes once a month, probably for every year between like 1966 and 1974. And then they kind of like abruptly stopped in 1974. And I found this very curious, and I really wanted to explore this more, I'm sure we can dive into this more too, but I found some interesting primary sources that essentially showed that the leading psychologist of the clinic, John Money, thought that the reason that the clinic closed was because of scandals occurring in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. And that's why I explored so much of these kind of background scandals going on, the Dalkin Shield scandal and the abortion scandals of the OBGYN clinic. And the reason I think that these are so involved with the closure of the clinic was because in 1974, that was like a key date for the clinic. The clinic was pushed out of the main Department of Surgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and it was forced to rely on the resources of the Department of OBGYN. And so I spent a lot of time kind of like looking at what was going on in the Department of OBGYN between 1974 and 1978, since there were no primary gender identity clinic meeting minutes to kind of look through. So that's kind of the second pillar of the argument. And the third pillar of the argument is the scientific study that was used to ultimately close the clinic in 1979, or better put, ban gender surgery at Hopkins in 1979. So This really important paper had been discussed previously by many, many other people. It's called Sex Reassignment Follow-Up by John Meyer and his secretary, Reeder. And John Meyer was an associate professor of, might have been assistant professor, associate professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, who was involved with the Gender Identity Clinic. He was actually the director for a period of time. And he decided later on that he didn't agree with performing surgery for people who are transgender. And so he kind of started to like work against the mission of the Gender Identity Clinic later on, past 1974. And so he published this paper that basically showed that there's no objective evidence to support gender surgery any longer. But my argument here is that at the same time, there are figures like John Money, a psychologist who was also leading the Gender Identity Clinic, who was very much in support of gender surgery at Johns Hopkins and wanted it to continue, but he didn't have as much power as somebody like John Meyer does. So we have John Money, the psychologist, versus John Meyer, the psychiatrist. And John Money wasn't able to get funding for his study that he was actively working on, that archival documents kind of support that he was actively working on a study of his own, but could never find funding. John Meyer was able to find funding and ultimately publish his 1979 paper. And again, I can go into the details of this, but those are kind of like the overarching arguments of my article. And all of these arguments kind of push against this notion that objective evidence was the reason that gender surgery was banned at Hopkins. You know, all of these factors kind of like support that that's not true.
So we want to hear more about the scandals, but maybe later. Mm-hmm. But I want to hear more about like these specific scandals that were influencing these decisions and like why these mm-hmm. meeting notes dropped off. Cause I think that's really fascinating. We love a historical yeah. scandal, mm-hmm. especially yeah, in a big hospital exactly. like Hopkins. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But okay. So I'm a historian of plastic surgery. So obviously this article is really, really interesting to me. I work mostly on reconstructive plastic surgery and facial reconstruction during the World Wars. But obviously, you know, gender confirming surgery was being pioneered kind of in that era as well. And as you're talking about, like in the post-war era. But one of the big themes in the history of plastic surgery is the need for plastic surgeons to constantly prove that they're serious surgeons. They're not just, you know, cosmetic doctors who do things that aren't necessary. And there's this constant pushback, like against them being called quacks or against them being called like charlatans. And so you mentioned that a little bit in your article, but I was wondering if you could speak more to how the need for plastic surgeons to prove themselves within the surgical realm and as a serious discipline also influenced this rise and fall of this gender affirming clinic.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question. It's something that I grappled with quite a bit during this research. And as I mentioned previously, I was interested in pursuing plastic surgery. So I became quite involved with the Department of Plastic Surgery here at Hopkins for a period of time. And some interesting background information that might be helpful for you, for anybody who doesn't really know much about the history of plastic surgery, is that here, you know, at a big major academic hospital like Johns Hopkins, they really favor doing procedures that are reconstructive, that are these huge sort of, you know, facial reconstructions or limb reconstructions that, you know, help people gain function, help people walk again, help people eat again on their own. And so that's like the huge focus of plastic surgery centers. But at the same time, there's this whole field of plastic surgery that's focused on aesthetics, that's focused on, you know, essentially making people look better. And this isn't as well-respected in academia. So, I mean, this is just based off of my own sense of plastic surgery, being a medical student, you know, navigating the department myself. So I found this kind of interesting. And basically, when it comes to gender-affirming surgery, I came to this conclusion not based off of, you know, prior research that has shown that like plastic surgery has constantly been trying to prove itself. I was very perplexed, actually, by this character, John Hoops, who I had previously talked about. So John Hoops, again, for context, he's the former chair of plastic surgery at Johns Hopkins. It was the inaugural director of the Gender Identity Clinic at Johns Hopkins in 1966. So we have this 1966 plastic surgeon who literally says, psychiatrists have not so far solved the problem of gender dysphoria, and that we need plastic surgeons to come in and maybe perhaps change the body to fix the mind. And that's something that he was arguing in 1966. But at the same time, when he came back in 1974, sorry, not at the same time, that's the whole point. You know, 8 years later or whatever, he comes back and he is using really offensive language to refer to transgender people. He's calling them, quote, freakish and artificial and masochistic and hypomanic and all of these you know, sorts of psychiatric terms at the time to describe trans people. And I found this quite perplexing, because it's like, how is this man leading the charge of gender surgery in 1966? And then suddenly being the biggest foe to the gender identity clinic at Johns Hopkins. And so I began to explore this more. I came up with a lot of hypotheses for why this was happening, but ultimately the only thing that really made sense to me was that, you know, John Hoops comes to Hopkins. He is an up and coming. He wants to become chief of plastic surgery one day. And he's leading the charge of gender surgery at Hopkins. And, you know, this is something that he thinks will perhaps raise the prestige of plastic surgery.
Is it that he thought that leading the gender-confirming gender identity clinic would raise the estimation of plastic surgery? Or is it that he thought 8 years later that doing these surgeries would lower the estimation of plastic surgery? Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. Yeah. So I think there's not so much evidence that, you know, he came to Hopkins and like wanted to raise the esteem of plastic surgery through gender surgery. But what is clear in 1974 onwards is that he is vehemently opposed to it. And he wrote like many, many letters to different people saying that he doesn't want the division of plastic surgery to have anything to do with gender surgery from 1974 onwards. And he makes clear that specifically he doesn't want plastic surgery to be involved. And at the same time, he's talking about his personal bias against trans people. He's talking about, you know, actually the clinical data doesn't support gender surgery any longer. I don't know. Seems like we shouldn't be doing this anymore. You know, like at the same time, he's using transphobic, offensive language to describe trans people. And so, you know, this to me really seemed like evidence that he was trying to discard of gender affirming surgery, and that this was a major motivation for him of kicking the gender identity clinic out of Johns Hopkins Hospital. And I think John Hoops is an extremely interesting character, because he starts off as somebody who, you know, wants to perform these surgeries and in support of these surgeries, and then is literally the person who says, you got to get out of here. Like you're no longer welcome in the general operating rooms of Johns Hopkins. And yeah, I just found him to be a very fascinating character because of this.
He's such an interesting figure to trace throughout your article, because yeah, it just shows you how one person's ideas can have such a sustained effect on other people's lives and ability to get the care that they need, which happens far too often in the history of medicine.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned these three scandals. It's like they're in your article, but I feel like these three scandals, say that five times fast, can be like a deeper like research paper of itself, or three different individual papers, to be honest. Like there's so much here. And the one that stands out the most to me is the Get Rich Quick scheme, where they were performing, you know, bringing in unlicensed physicians, as you say on page three. In 1976, Johns Hopkins received an anonymous letter that accused King of a, quote, get-rich-quick scheme in 1973 that had netted the Department of OBGYN several million dollars, and it accused King of allowing 200 to 250 unlicensed physicians born outside the U.S. to perform abortions and sterilizations on, quote, disadvantaged welfare women from 1973 to 1975, resulting in substantial morbidity. I'm just like, that's a dissertation. Like, seriously. But no, I was just wondering if you could say more about the scandals, how and why they stood out to you, and what should we make of them?
Yeah, thank you for reading that out loud. I think that's a really important point. And, you know, often a lot of people read my article and they like the scandals are kind of like the bottom of what they bring up, just because, you know, I the scandals are kind of background information that help you like view what is going on in this specific microcosm at this period of time. And I find them very helpful, just because you kind of see how academic medicine is viewing itself relative to the outside world and to policy going on. And so I found these abortion scandals and the Dalkin Shield scandal is very interesting, because here we have the medical establishment regulating technologies of the reproductive system, basically. Like, we have this abortion scandal that you talked about. And admittedly, there's really only one document that I can find that links the abortion scandal to like what's going on in OBGYN. There's not a lot of information about it. All I can find is John Money, again, the psychologist, sort of reflecting on how Theodore King, the chair of OBGYN, has been negatively impacted by the abortion clinics that he supports. So I forget what year he came to Hopkins, but Theodore King was a sort of more progressive figure at the time of OBGYN chiefs. And he wanted to make sure that Hopkins was in the business of providing abortions to patients, which was really important at the time. And this was causing his department a lot of, you know, negative sort of press. And there was all sorts of pressure coming from all directions of like whether or not from the right and from the left, like you shouldn't be performing these procedures. Like this is, you know, as we hear in today's rhetoric. But this sort of scandal letter that I quote in the article that you were just talking about is an interesting one because it's basically this letter that outlines, I think it comes a little more from the left here. Like these abortion programs that you guys are performing are having all of these human rights violations. You guys are trying to get money from the federal government. You're trying to do this, this, and that. And whether these claims are true or not, and I'm sure there is some truth to it. I mean, there's plenty of documentation of, you know, forced sterilizations and stuff like that in, you know, the 70s and well before that. But whether or not it's true, it shows the sort of pressure that the Department of OBGYN was under during that time. They would get these anonymous letters that look like they're going to take down the department. They're going to take away the NIH's funding for OBGYN. You know, like these are very sort of like threatening letters that the department was sort of, you know, grappling with at the time. Yeah. And so John Money was just talking about in these letters that he left behind that the abortion clinics at Johns Hopkins were providing a lot of negative press for the department and how that sort of like tied to the gender identity clinic, which was now under the purview of OBGYN. Another scandal that was happening at the same time, the Dalkin Shield scandal. So the Dalkin Shield was an old intrauterine device IUD prototype. Previously, obstetricians and gynecologists really relied upon sort of like injectable contraceptives and a pill contraceptive. But this was like kind of the first time that IUDs were emerging as possible alternatives. And one of the first prototypes that came out was at Johns Hopkins, sort of established by this professor of OBGYN, Hugh Davis. And this prototype, the Dalkin Shield, kind of looked like a crab. It would sit in the uterus and it had these projections. And then they had these like these strings that came down that most IUDs now have. But the Dalkin Shield strings were multi-filament strings. And so they could seed infection basically from the vaginal microbiome up to the uterus and cause severe inflammatory disease. And this wasn't known during the like prototype development and the validation studies for the Dalkin Shield. And Hugh Davis was like, you know, this device is great. It's going to save so much money. It's going to be a great alternative. He testified before the U.S. Senate even and was like, IUDs are it. We shouldn't be doing the pill any longer. We shouldn't be doing injectable contraceptives any longer. And then it comes out a few years later that this prototype is causing, you know, some severe inflammatory reactions. It resulted in multiple deaths and it was rapidly taken off the market. And this huge scandal like enveloped the Department of OBGYN after this. And like a lot of people know about the Dalkin Shield today, believe it or not. And yeah, it's just part of one of the dark histories of Johns Hopkins that is actually involved with the history of the gender identity clinic here, because while the gender identity clinic was struggling to survive in its final years, like under in the OBGYN department, in the women's clinic, at the same time, this department was being questioned by the School of Medicine. It was being questioned by reporters. It was being questioned by other professors in the School of Medicine. You know, like, what are you all doing? Where's the oversight? Like, what's happening here? And in this sort of squeeze, in this sort of pressure cooker that was happening with this, these abortion scandals, with the Dawkins Shields scandal, there was just no room to function for the gender identity clinic any longer. And so this was kind of like the last straw, I think, for why the gender identity clinic couldn't really save itself from its downfall.
That is so interesting. Of course it was a crab, in like Maryland. In Maryland, like everything is a crab, you know, like, so you're describing the shape of this IUD and I'm like, ugh, of course they're everywhere.
Yeah, you should look it up. It looks pretty scary. Yeah, but it was the filaments at the end that was like the filaments that came down that actually, yeah.
No, that's really good background. Thank you so much. And, you know, this talk of abortion as well as gender confirming surgery, of course, is making me think of questions and debates and scandals today. And so I'm wondering if the headline for an article you were interviewed for in Stat, the headline was "History is Repeating Itself." And so, of course, you know, the question that we ask all of our guests is, you know, when they're dealing with the history of medicine, okay, how does your historical work relate to problems and debates around the practice of medicine today? So I'm wondering if you could tie a bit more, which you've already, you know, I'm sure that listeners are already drawing connections to everything that's in the news today. But I'm wondering if you could draw a bit more between this article and the archival work that you're doing to what's going on right now.
Absolutely. And I'd like to preface with what I'm going to say with two things. One, that I am not a representative of Johns Hopkins Medicine, and that what I say about this reflects my own personal opinions and the evidence that I've seen in the archives myself. Second of all, I want to recognize that I am a cisgendered white man. While I do identify as gay and LGBTQ, like that's not the same thing as being transgender or gender diverse. And I want to recognize that the people that can like truly reflect on the impact of this sort of historical work are the trans and gender diverse people who are like actively fighting against this sort of stigma. And so, as we all know, Roe versus Wade was overturned very recently. At the same time, there's been this sort of vitriol, sort of like increased bigotry and hatred directed against LGBTQ people. There have been, as we know, murders and killings of trans people, of gay people. There have been protests of drag performances. There have been widespread systemic efforts to, you know, sort of ban discussion about gender identity and sexual orientation and at the education level in Florida. And so I think this article is really important right now because we are facing a time in our history where our institutions are facing a lot of resistance from conservative pressures and religious pressures to work against gender affirming care and to work against equal access to healthcare for LGBTQ people. We see this in the Supreme Court. We see this in state legislatures across the country. And quite honestly, it's very concerning. And I find it to be very concerning as an LGBTQ person in America. And that's why I felt so inspired by this work first place. And so I think this work really relates to what's currently going on because I think this work shows how science can be used as a sort of mask to legitimize certain theories and certain stigmas that are held by a lot of people to essentially like support the marginalization of those people. So a lot of what we're seeing today in state legislatures, we have people like Paul McHugh, but other people as well, who are well-respected, high-ranking medical practitioners who present medical evidence in support of ending gender surgery, saying that gender surgery is not effective, saying that it is not something that our institutions should be invested in. And this is still occurring. I believe it was in Alabama, the state the attorney general, one of the attorney generals in Alabama, was literally like citing a paper that has been like dismissed by a lot of people in the scientific community as like inaccurate and having poor methodology. But these sorts of scientific evidence are presently being weaponized in order to support state legislature efforts to end gender-affirming surgery. And so this is a very present issue. And something I've been frustrated about being a medical student and, you know, working in the medical field is that people often blindly will say, look at this paper. This paper supports this. We go with this reasoning. And I think it's essential for us, especially in this day and age of conservative rhetoric and politics, that we unpack and we really interrogate and we examine this medical evidence and we compare it to other medical evidence and we converse with our colleagues around the world and see what's happening, and that we don't just take something for its face value and use it as support of what will be very widespread altering of policy.
But you did say something that did pique our interest and was sort of cued for one of our questions before we finish our conversation that we did want to tease out a bit more. You know, you mentioning being a medical student and having to think through these things and work with or within fields that sort of legitimizes anti-LGBTQIA plus rights and such. So you, as a medical student with a, you know, history of medicine concentration, curious if you can speak more to how, you know, why do you think medical students should engage in, you know, historical research and or work in the medical humanities like you did with this piece?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think medical students aren't exposed enough to the humanities and social sciences. A lot of medical students and a lot of people who hope to practice clinical medicine really only focus on the science and medicine aspects of medicine, but that's just not what clinical medicine is. There's so much social work. There's so much interacting with the social determinants of health and making sure that your patients don't feel stigmatized and don't feel judged. And all of these things contribute to a therapeutic alliance with a patient. And if you're interacting with an LGBTQ patient and you're not aware of how your institution or how others in your institution have negatively affected that population, then you're not doing your job and you're not catering appropriately to where that patient is at, and you're going to potentially damage that therapeutic alliance and prevent that patient from, you know, returning to care. And so I think these sorts of issues are extremely important and they're not focused on enough in medical education. I'll give you a more specific example. In our preclinical sort of course on psychiatry, we were learning all about the sorts of theories of gender dysphoria, and especially at Johns Hopkins, and they were talking about the perspective of Dr. Paul McHugh again, who we have discussed previously on of transgender people, and how he believes that how we should try to change the mind instead of the body. And these sorts of theories are constantly interwoven in our education. Our education is not objective science and medicine. It reflects an institution. It reflects our institutional values. And if we aren't equipped, we as medical students aren't equipped to unpack that information that we're receiving, and if we're not equipped to question and interrogate it, then what are we doing? What are we doing as leaders of medicine? Otherwise, we're just following algorithms. We're just treating people. We're not leading medicine. We're not caring for patients if we don't question these things. And so that's why I think it's important.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. You're preaching to the choir here as two humanities people, who also, you know, teach medical students and practitioners. So we're like, yes, yes, and, yes. If only everybody, if only every student that we've ever taught embedded in a medical system felt the way that you did, then we'd have a very different system.
Or half.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm sort of wishing that we saved that question for last, because that was answer so was like a mic drop, but
yeah.
We're milking this.
But right that now. Was really good. Thank you so much. So, you know, back to kind of what we were talking a bit about, how you came to this project and your process of using historical methods. You know, a big element of the humanities is getting deep into the archives and using this historical material. So I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit more about your experience of working within the Chesney Archives here at Hopkins. And if there was any, I mean, we've talked about a lot of surprising tidbits from your research, but if there was anything else within the archive that really surprised you or jumped out that you weren't expecting to find.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as I was mentioning before, I think the most exciting part of this research was getting to work in the archives, looking at these primary documents, kind of reciting in your head what these historical actors were saying as they typed out or wrote out the documents that you're reading. I think it's extremely fascinating and one of the blessings of historical research. What I've found to be surprising is the way how you can be looking through like dozens of documents, lots and lots of documents. And then you hit one that's like, oh my gosh, like what is that I'm looking at? And then it sends you down rabbit holes. I find historical research is a lot of rabbit holes, and a lot of them lead to dead ends. But sometimes during the research, you really hit a gold mine and you find all of these really interesting documents through that one first document that you found, and then you follow the rabbit hole, these really interesting documents that begin to tell a story. And I think it's really lovely to be able to sort of piece together all of these different documents and start to come up with a story, a timeline of events that are happening. And I found it to be extremely exciting.
Experience resonates with both of us. And if you're not trained in history, like that's such a surprising experience. Cause I feel like in movies, especially like when they show people in the archives, you find the right box and then you've got what you went there to see. When in reality, it's like you go through 16 boxes and then in the 17th, you might find one.
Oh, a document.
Yeah. Just one. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm glad you've had that experience as well.
And with that, I'm going to shuffle a couple questions, but, after detailing that experience, curious if you can tell us, what kind of other, history of medicine or, social medicine work, can we look forward to from you? And how do you see yourself taking this forward? Because we hope this isn't the end of your work over here on this side.
Well, thank you for asking that. I'm very excited for what the future holds. As I was alluding to, there's been some question of what specialty I kind of want to go into. And I think I've realized that I actually do want to go into psychiatry. So that's a big change over the last year. In this vein, I think the part of the reason that I'm so interested in psychiatry is because I think there's a lot of work to be done, first of all. And second of all, I think there's so much opportunity for working in the social humanities and sort of LGBTQIA activism in psychiatry, especially with this sort of like negative history that's gone on with the field of psychiatry as it relates to gay and trans people. I find it even more empowering to maybe one day be a gay psychiatrist and to be able to, have a gay patient and be like, you don't have to worry around me. You don't have to pretend that you are using condoms all the time or you're taking PrEP every single day. You can tell me all of these details because I'm not going to judge you. And so, sorry, I'm going down a rabbit hole, but anyways, this is sort of like my motivation of pursuing something like psychiatry. But as it relates to other work, I'm definitely interested still in the history of medicine. I've been working with a psychiatrist at Harvard, one of the editorialists who replied to my article, actually, Dr. Karoglian. And I've been working a lot with him. He does a lot with sort of LGBTQIA equity work, especially with gender affirming care. And I'm currently just interested in ways that the field of psychiatry have informed current violence and negative rhetoric against queer people. And so I'm kind of working on something like that right now. And I don't want to give too many details, but I think that is kind of what you can expect from me in the future. A lot more of this sort of work, maybe not entirely history of medicine any longer, more present day. But yeah, I'm excited to be in the trenches working on this sort of stuff. So
Beautiful, beautiful. And you did mention that you're already working with someone who commented on your paper. Are there other scholars and writers, you know, at Hopkins, Harvard, or elsewhere, you know, who have influenced your work, your work around the history of medicine and history of psychiatry, the medical humanities in general, or people who you are looking forward to working with?
Yeah, I think there are many extremely gifted trans scholars, even just here at Johns Hopkins. The first of which who comes to mind is Jules Gill Peterson. But there are people working on this all across the country. People have met at conferences, both in the history of medicine and just clinical medicine, who are doing this important work. And, you know, it'd be very difficult to name all of them. But yeah, and I also, you know, of course, would thank Jeremy Green first and foremost, because, you know, he's a fantastic mentor. He's very good at historical writing, and I learned so much working with him. And this sort of work wouldn't have been anything without him.
Awesome. We love it. That's perfect. Great. Thank you so much. This was such a wonderful conversation. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I feel like I learned a lot, and I really appreciate your perspective.
Same. Usually I feel bad for Christy because Christy does the editing, but I'm like, I mean,
easy peasy.
It was lovely working with you guys. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this work. And I loved listening to your previous podcast. They're very interesting.
Thank you.